So how long we got? Where's our destination today?
I don't know. We got 20 miles to cover. Let's talk some movies. People don't know how to drive.
Are we going to get lunch on this gig? You see anything good recently?
Not really. We got a little time, Steve. Let's do a podcast.
Sounds good.
Welcome to another edition of Film Driven. I'm Andre Shane.
I'm Steve Haskin.
And we're driving through the beautiful flatlands of Illinois. Southern Illinois there, Steve. Beautiful country.
Yeah. There's a lot of trees, a lot of farmland.
Yes. It's lovely. But one thing it's not is funny.
No, I suppose it's not.
Which segues us into our topic today. That's comedy. Kind of a broad topic.
It is a broad topic, yeah. But we thought we would talk about some of our favorites, some of our least favorites, and maybe even discuss, like, what makes a good, funny movie.
Indeed. And, you know, comedy's been the bread and butter of Hollywood since the beginning. You know, the biggest movie stars in the early days in the silent era were, for the most part, comedians. It was Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Fatty Arbuckle.
Sure.
Those kind of guys. They were huge. And, of course, the reason Hollywood loves comedies is that you don't need to spend $200 million to make a funny movie that can make a lot of money.
No. Comedies are cheap.
Yes. And that's
kind
of good, comparatively speaking. You
Once
know?
You pay for the star, then it's not too hard.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a nice thing. But, you know, comedy is also hard, right? That's what they say. Dying is easy, comedy's hard, the old joke.
Sure.
It is hard, Steve, because, you know, if you really go through your mind and think of, like, some of your favorite movies, most people tend to not name comedies in that for some reason. Why is that?
Yeah, well, it's also considered just less than.
It is.
Like, I never have an exact answer to that question, like, what's your all-time favorite
movie? No, no.
But one time, under pressure, I answered The Graduate, and I got some looks. Like, some,
well,
like...
because The Graduate's kind of like a comedy, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Yeah. Like, kind of like, oh, I thought you were, a real film buff, and that's a lightweight answer.
It's not The Godfather? It's not Citizen Kane?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, interesting.
So, well, I immediately changed it to Meshes of the Afternoon, and then we were great.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, comedy, of course, along the same lines, really gets shafted at the Oscars. I mean, comedies very rarely win Best Picture, Annie Hall being one of the few exceptions.
And comedic actors are almost never awarded.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm positive that a great comedic performance is considerably more tricky to pull off for an actor than a great dramatic performance.
Sure.
And yet... never. I mean, you really, really so rarely see people nominated. Sometimes you see supporting actors who are kind of comic relief in a movie nominated.
Yes.
You know, but a straight-up lead comedic performance is very rarely acknowledged.
I'm trying to think, yeah. Has either actor or actress, can you think of a situation where the best actor or best actress was from a comedy?
Supporting, you do get that, but as a lead...
I guess the one asterisk is the category of romantic comedies. This is the subgenre of comedies that seems like a completely different world from, say, an Adam Sandler movie.
But, I mean, comedy, it is such a broad topic for us to discuss, Steve, and it's... And you know, I had difficulty wrapping my mind about what we're going to really talk about when we talk about the comedies. And I think what we need to actually discuss is in fact, different subgenres within comedies. And obviously, the romantic comedy's been around for a long time. I mean, you can argue that Charlie Chaplin's City Lights is a romantic comedy. It certainly has a romantic... dilemma at the center of it. And then, of course, you know, you can go through some of your favorites, like Some Like It Hot is kind of a romantic comedy.
Sure, Bringing Up Baby, all sorts of things, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of these screwball comedies from the 30s and, you know, a lot of what's considered to be great films, like My Man Godfrey and Bringing Up Baby and Billy Wilder's stuff. You know, a lot of that stuff definitely falls under the subheading of romantic comedy. But, you know, that category didn't really exist back then. Rom-com is kind of a recent thing. It sort of arose in the, I'd say, in the 70s. And I think the person who really brought that about was, in fact, Woody Allen, with some of his, particularly with Annie Hall, but definitely Manhattan, definitely Hannah and Her Sister. You know, really the pinnacle of his film career really is romantic comedies, or movies that deal seriously with the subject of romance, and in many ways are not strict comedies. In other words, they have drama in them.
Sure. Well, I feel like in some ways most romantic comedies are only comedies in the Shakespearean sense of not being dramas.
Right.
That, you know, they're lighter on their feet. And that doesn't mean there's not real emotions involved, but it's just, you know, going into romantic comedy that for the most part you're in for a good time. And there are exceptions, but, you know, the genre is made, kind of designed to have a happy ending.
Right. Right. It's not a comedy unless it has a happy ending. And some comedies have, you know, kind of vague endings, you know? I mean, like, you mentioned The Graduate, and The Graduate's an interesting example because, you know, The Graduate is basically a comedy. It's certainly funny, but it's got a lot to say.
Sure.
And it's got drama in it. It's got dramatic stuff. And it has an ending that could be interpreted as happy. But, you know, that last shot in the movie certainly doesn't scream they lived happily ever after, does it?
No.
And you find that with a lot of comedies that I like, you find a little bit of a subversion of the happy ending. You know, Annie Hall doesn't have a particularly happy ending. They don't end up together.
Correct.
And Manhattan, the other great romantic comedy from Woody, also not particularly a happy ending. I kind of like that, you know? It's an interesting, I mean, it's not a sad ending. They don't die. You know, they become better people as a result of their experiences. But things are not all great at the end of it. That kind of brings me to the fact that I think my favorite comedies tend to be slightly more serious in nature. They have a subtext that's a little bit more serious than just wacky stuff. And so, you know, so I sort of split the comedy as a big genre into like little subgenres. And the way basically I split it is you got the romantic comedy that we talked about, and that includes all of the films that we talked about. Then you have kind of a serious, semi-serious comedies, you know, comedies that have a message, have something to say, perhaps social satire of some sort. A movie like, well, say, Dr. Strangelove, for example, that has a certainly funny, but it has a serious subtext. A movie like Adaptation, which is funny, but also has something profound to say about the creative process. There's those kind of movies. And then there's just the silly comedies, and they basically include everything else from, you know, spoofs like Austin Powers to virtually everything that Will Ferrell or Adam Sandler do.
Yes, that those movies have pretty much no agenda other than making you laugh.
That's right.
And those tend to me to be the most subjective. Because they basically, those movies live and die on the jokes and the performer.
Right.
And what you as a viewer think of them.
Right. And so, and it's amazing the degree to which some of them work and some of them don't work.
Yes.
Like, we're talking about silly comedy. In my opinion, like, Will Ferrell makes the best silly comedies out there right now. Not everything works.
I would agree.
But when I sort of look at his oeuvre, I go, well, you got Anchorman, you got Talladega Nights, you got Blades of Glory, you got Old School to some extent, you know, not entirely a Will Ferrell movie. I mean, it's great stuff. It's really, better really than, friggin'
like,
funny.
Say, Adam Sandler movies or...
Or, you know, your classic Jim Carrey movie or something along those lines.
Or a Martin Lawrence comedy. You know, there are these performers that they make these type of movies, and, you know, Kevin James is starting to make some of these movies.
Right.
And they're very successful, and people love them.
A lot of times they're successful.
When those movies are successful, I usually just kind of tip my hat in a way of like, well, that's just not my bag,
right,
to quote Austin Powers.
Yes.
And that's what I mean about those movies live and die on, you know, like your average Adam Sandler movie. And there's some Adam Sandler movies I like. Like, I think Happy Gilmore is really hilarious. But most Adam Sandler movies, I mean, I was...
Is Happy Gilmore the golf one?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's like one of the best Adam Sandler movies.
Yeah, like I was in...
If not the best.
I was in high school and college when a lot of those movies were coming out. And so I, you know, through friends, I saw a lot of them. And most of them boils down to, it's like Adam Sandler in a funny haircut with a funny voice doing stuff. And that's the plot. And the whole movie rests on how funny you think it is when Adam Sandler has this particular haircut or that particular voice.
Right.
Like, there's not a lot of story to hang your hat on, and by design. And so, you know, those movies, the other thing about those movies that I feel no matter who the performer is that they have in common that always kind of bugs me is from a visual standpoint, those movies are usually really lazy.
I think that's the answer to the question of why they don't get a lot of respect. Because they are built around strictly the gag. Everything's about the gag. Hit a home run with a gag, one gag at a time, pack it in, and you got a success. And I think there is really two people that created that, or I should say maybe three or four people who created that. Mel Brooks and the Zucchers with Airplane.
Sure.
They created this kind of subgenre of comedy that just throws jokes at you. Just throws a lot of jokes. Some of them are stupid. Some of them are smart. But basically, the concept is to just bombard you with as many jokes as possible. And you know you're going to walk out of the theater having laughed.
Yes.
And there's a lot to be said. And you know, those movies, the Mel Brooks movies... and, you know, Mel Brooks is almost an exception. I mean, I love Airplane. Airplane is one of my favorite comedies ever because it is a purely comedic, like, it's a smorgasbord. It's got low comedy. It's got high comedy. It's got physical comedy. It's got smart, like, really clever comedy as well. It's got every type of comedy rolled into one, and it just throws it into you. I love Airplane. But Airplane, in and of itself, is not what you'd call a well-constructed film. It's a film that throws gags at you.
Sure.
Mel Brooks, you know, I would say Blazing Saddles falls into the category of, like, throwing a lot of gags at you within a kind of making fun of the Western genre. But, you know, but once you get to, like, Young Frankenstein, which came out the same year, then you're kind of getting into an area that this is actually a good film. Because it is thought out, and a lot of the gags are very cinematic in nature, and the film looks great, and there is a, you know, there's a structure to it that's not quite as loose as Blazing Saddles. So there's a little bit of a difference there, but I think Mel Brooks and the Zuckers, Zucker, Abram Zucker, they kind of created the silly comedy genre in the 70s, and now guys like Adam Sandler and, you know, Jim Carrey in his day, and Will Ferrell now, they're kind of working in the same area a lot of times, you know?
Yeah. Some of those movies work better than others, and sometimes it's hard for me to put my finger on what they are, other than some of them just seem funnier to me.
Yeah.
You know, like Blades of Glory is funnier to me than the basketball movie.
Semi-Pro, I think, is the name of the basketball movie.
You're right. Whereas, like, the average Adam Sandler movie, you really get the sense that sometimes it's like, Adam Sandler's the water boy, and he walks around and does a funny voice, and they're like, great, start shooting. And they do. Like, you know, they've not worked out anything else really for the water boy to do, or what, that they're like, that's enough. That, you know, the tagline of the movie is not just the hook, it's the whole movie, you know?
Right.
And sometimes that's worked out, and sometimes it hasn't.
Yeah. Well, it's incredibly subjective, and that's basically, that is another reason, I think, why comedy does not get a lot of respect, so to speak, because it is so subjective. I mean, for example, you may find Adam Sandler hilarious. A lot of people do. I can watch an Adam Sandler movie and literally not even smile one time. But it's so friggin' subjective. If you personally do not find Adam Sandler's shtick funny, that's it. His movies can't work for you. You will not enjoy them. I do not like the Adam Sandler movie that he did with Paul Thomas Anderson.
Punch Drunk Love?
Punch Drunk Love. I hate Punch Drunk Love because I do not respond to Adam Sandler. I just don't respond to him. I don't think he's a good actor. I don't think he's a funny comedian. That's it. There's nothing that will change that. I find Jim Carrey sometimes funny, but when Jim Carrey, like, does the broad characters, doesn't do much for me.
But Will Ferrell, on the other hand, you do find funny.
Exactly.
So you give him more leeway.
Absolutely. So Will Ferrell can goof around, but it also has limitations. Like,
yeah.
I saw that movie that was in Spanish. Casa de mi Padre.
Yeah.
You know, it was a one joke movie. It had a concept that everybody's going to speak Spanish, and they're going to kind of make fun of the telenovelas. And that was it. Beyond that, the movie had nothing going for it. So even though, yes, I do find Will Ferrell hilarious, in fact, in that movie, I didn't find him funny. I didn't find that political comedy that he made last year very funny.
The Campaign.
Either. The Campaign with Zach Galifianakis, who I also find funny, but that movie just didn't work. So there's a limit, even to guys that are hilarious, there's still a limit where it could get messy and overindulgent.
Well, then there are these other movies that are the more serious movies where certainly actors can give capable, like, really hilarious performances, but the movies are not necessarily designed as a pure vehicle for just one performer. There's
right.
There's something else going on.
Right.
There's a storyline.
Sure.
An example would be any of the movies of, like, Alexander Payne or Wes Anderson.
Right.
And I mean, some of my favorite funny comedies I've laughed at over the past 20 or 30 years are by the Coen brothers. You know, they write roles for specific actors, but it's not the same as, you know, Adam Sandler is Little Nicky.
Yes. I don't want to rank on Adam Sandler too much. He's extremely successful and he's a nice guy from what I understand. People don't loathe working with him for the most part. But there is a different echelon of filmmakers out there who do make comedies, but for some reason people don't think of them as comedies. Like Coen Brothers, not every film they make is a comedy. I mean, No Country for Old Men is clearly not a comedy.
Sure.
Even though that too has
humor
in it.
Yeah, it does have humor. And I mean, you could argue that most of their films are actually comedies.
Well, certainly Raising Arizona is a straight-up comedy. Fargo has a lot of comedic aspects to it. Obviously, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is actually a comedy.
That's a comedy. The Hudsucker Proxy is a comedy.
Clearly, yes, absolutely. Lady Killers,
one
of the worst.
Big Lebowski is a comedy.
Big Lebowski, absolutely comedy.
Burn
but,
After Reading is a comedy.
Yeah. So they've made a lot of straight-up comedies. And but yet, you know, when people think of the Coen brothers, they're not thinking comedy filmmakers. They're very rarely lumped with comedic filmmakers. You know?
Sure.
I mean, you very rarely hear, like, Coen Brothers and Judd Apatow, you know, in the
same
exactly. sentence.
Like, if people were discussing, like, well, who are the most prominent directors of comedies right now? People would probably say, you know, they'd be Judd Apatow. They would mention Adam McKay, who does most of Will Ferrell's
movies.
Films,
uh-huh.
They might mention Jay Roach. They would probably mention the guy to the Hangover movies, Todd Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they would not necessarily be like, who are the prime? You wouldn't say, oh yeah, Wes Anderson, Spike Jones, the Coen brothers. Even though for me, like, I've laughed more at, you know, I personally have laughed more at those movies than the movies of Jay Roach.
Right. What's your take on Judd Apatow? Now, Judd Apatow is extremely successful, or at least he was a few years ago, and his career is kind of weird. And it seems like he's both trying and not trying at the same time. I can't really wrap my mind around what that guy's doing in terms of his film career.
Well, Judd Apatow is very interesting, because as I was, you know, mentally preparing for this podcast, I kept kind of circling around it. Judd Apatow seems like a very towering figure in comedy, especially in comedy movies over the past 10 years. And my question I don't have a definitive answer to is he a hero or is he a villain? Because Judd Apatow, for years now, has been, not only does he make his own movies, but he's this kind of comedic godfather to a whole host of people, like Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd and Jason Segel. All of these people have, like, written movies recently that Judd Apatow helped get made.
Right.
So he's responsible for bringing a lot of prominent comedies to the screen in one way or the other. Now, all of that's commendable, and supposedly being around Judd Apatow is he's a great guy, and he encourages you to write and to come up with things. And his own movies have seemed to have kind of a personal angle. My problem, like, where I come in the villain side is there's two things. I mean, number one, just strictly from a filmmaking perspective, Judd Apatow is the enemy of, like, interesting filmmaking. And he himself has admitted that he's not very good visually, but the Judd Apatow style is to lock down the camera and shoot everything as conventional as possible, so that way it gives maximum space for improvisation from your actors.
Right.
So the whole movie is driven by what the actors say to each other. No sight gags necessarily, so, you know, you can't have an elaborate dolly move because that would interrupt Paul Rudd's improv.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's a Woody Allen school of directing, isn't it?
Sure. Though I've told Woody Allen is a little more script-based. Like, Judd Apatow is...
is more, you know, improvised,
It's not quite a Christopher Guest level, somebody else we should mention, where, like, there's literally... I mean, Christopher Guest in something like Curb Your Enthusiasm, there's supposedly, like, literally no script.
It's heavily improv, yes. Yeah.
But, I mean, like, there's no written lines
there's
of dialogue.
There's a guy. With where you're going with every scene.
Setting. Yes. You know who the characters are, and you know why they're there, but there are no lines written. Woody Allen and Judd Apatow, I mean, like, Judd Apatow, there are lines. You know, but the lines are very fluid. And he's quite content to, like, always be revamping. And that sounds interesting and exciting, but the downside, and it's my second problem with Judd Apatow, Judd Apatow has directed 4 movies now. Each movie is worse than the one that preceded it, to the point where his last movie, This Is 40, I mean, I thought that movie was actively bad.
He seems to be devolving as a quality filmmaker. I haven't seen This Is 40, although, you know, being in my
40s. You've heard me rant about it several times, yeah.
I kind of wanted to see it. Yeah. It looked like it had the elements of being a decent movie. I like Paul Rudd. I like those characters. I mean, these are the same characters from Knocked Up, and I like those characters in that film. And I like those actors, and it seems like, well, you know, why wouldn't I like This Is 40? And it seems like I wouldn't, from what you're telling me.
To me, Judd Apatow has almost devolved into a higher-brow version of these Adam Sandler films, where he has so much faith in his actors that he thinks he can get away with just, like, shit-canning all elements of the story. That, like, all we want to do is hang out with the actors. And what's interesting is that it almost makes it worse to me than one of these wacky star vehicles, because his actors are playing characters that are far less likable. Like, if I'm going to spend 90 minutes with Will Ferrell just acting wacky, like, well, at least it's Will Ferrell acting wacky. But that's different from spending 2.5 hours with Leslie Mann and Paul Rudd, who are kind of non-likable characters. So they're improvising in a framework that's part funny, but also part, you know, fighting married people.
Right, right. Yeah, it's like watching, your married friends fight for a half an hour.
Yeah.
And that could be fun in real life. But, you know, on a screen. And also, you know, the thing about Judd Apatow is extremely overindulgent in terms of running time.
Sure.
Like, every one of his films is fat. Like, every one of his films could have stuff cut out of it and be a lot better. Comedies really should be 90 minutes long. I mean, that's just my
general
rule.
Sure, well, that's Woody Allen's rule, and I gotta say, the only filmmaker, you know, maybe some of these smaller comedic ones, but Christopher Guest is a filmmaker who also subscribes to that rule, more or less, and I think it's a good rule.
I think it's a great rule, and if you see some of the greatest comedy films, they're all in that time frame. And Judd Apatow is, you know, on the one hand, I commend anybody for breaking convention, but, you know, his films are friggin'
Yeah,
they just feel like over stuff. There's too much going on. Sometimes there's subplots that go nowhere that are not funny. There's no payoff to a lot of stuff. He makes it tough to, like, respect him in many ways, you know? Like I do respect him because he is successful and he's a smart dude, but come on. It's like he doesn't seem to have somebody in his camp who can kind of go like, you know, Judd, cut this sucker down by half an hour.
Sure.
You'll have a better film. And then we, the audience, have to sit there and, you know, lose half an hour of our life on this inane subplot that doesn't add anything to the film and subtracts from the film. And that's kind of annoying. So I understand where you're coming from.
Well, and I mean, specifically, is not to spend too much time on This Is 40, but that movie has scenes where he just, like, forgets about basic movie-going conventions, where, like, one character will leave a party, and then two scenes later, that character's still at the party.
Yeah,
and
that's
you're
sloppy.
Like, that's just insane, you know?
Yeah.
Or, like, one character says, all right, I'm leaving, and then two scenes later, that character's in the car with someone, and you're like, well, why are they in the car? And it's like he's improv'd himself just right out of the script.
Yeah.
That he just rolled with whatever thing. And that's a sign of, to me, a director who's just lost control of the project. That in the heat of the moment, he just lets his actors do whatever. And then in the editing room, he's like, okay, I'm just going to go with whatever's funny. But then it does, you know, you lose all the logic sense of it.
Well, yeah, because especially since he does not make the kind of films where, like, Airplane, for example.
Sure.
That you just, like, accept no matter what it... the ridiculousness of anything happening. You know what I mean? Like a lot of Will Ferrell movies, I mean, they have the reality basis of a Roadrunner cartoon. You know, you're not expecting reality in those films. You know, Talladega Nights, you know, he gets mauled by a cougar, you know, and then comes home 10 minutes later with a smudge on his chest, and that's it, you know? Believe me, getting mauled by a cougar is a lot more dramatic than that, Steve. Believe me. So, because Apatow's films do seem to be based in some sort of human universe that we live in, it makes it even more egregious when he does this kind of stuff. It just feels more sloppy.
And it's just disheartening, too, to me that I wish he would take more visual chances and then trust in his premise and go... I mean, like, the great thing about 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up is those movies were, like, you know, he had a great story and a personalized story, and there's room for some improv in that, but then he trusted to his story.
Right.
And, I don't know, like, to me, almost the anti-Judd Apatow of a guy who doesn't do a ton of improv and does a lot of camera movement is Edgar Wright, who directed Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and now with our podcast is a shade premature because... The World's End comes out very soon.
Absolutely, and that looks great. Exactly, and Edgar Wright is very, very calculated. His gags are very cinematic. He does a lot of, you know, a lot of his stuff is kind of operates in the spoof land, you know? I mean...
Sure.
But it's very effective, and he's very good at it. You know, especially Shaun of the Dead. I mean, that's just a great movie. It's not a movie that's... like, doesn't take the whole zombie thing seriously either. It kind of does take it seriously. And it works with a metaphor, it works within the convention, and yet it's funny. And very cinematic. And same for Hot Fuzz and, you know, pretty much everything else the guy does. Certainly Scott Pilgrim, that's a wackier movie, but...
Scott Pilgrim was, you know, an adaptation.
True,
the other movies are things him and Simon Pegg conceived of together.
Yeah.
But they're interesting because I recently heard an interview on the What the Fuck podcast with Simon Pegg.
Don't plug other podcasts, Steve.
Yeah, we actually need the reverse, right? We need Mark Maron to give us a shout-out.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
How they work is they start with maybe a sincere premise, and then kind of add the genre topping to that. And like you say, Shaun of the Dead, they take the zombie convention seriously, but their goal wasn't going into like, oh, we should make a zombie movie that's like funny. Their goal was they came up with a movie about moving on from friendships you've outgrown and things, but then they're like, well, what if that was in the milieu of a zombie movie? And that helps like lighten the that sometimes Simon Pegg says him and Edgar Wright's their concepts, they're like, well, we just did that straight, it's a little too earnest. And they said, for example, their whole thing going into Shaun of the Dead was, it's a Mike Lee movie with zombies.
Yeah.
That they're like, the Mike Lee movie might be a little too heavy-handed for them. So, like, let's just lighten the tone a little bit.
Right. Yeah, and when it comes to these comedy auteurs, I think we have to mention Albert Brooks to some extent.
Sure.
And Albert Brooks doesn't make a lot of films. He works very slowly. And there's kind of this legend about Albert Brooks. I don't know if I necessarily buy it. I'm not sure I like Albert Brooks movies as much as some people like Albert Brooks movies, but I do like a couple of his movies a lot. And my favorite Albert Brooks movie is, I think, his first movie that he's ever made, which was in the early 70s. It's called Real Life, and it's a friggin' masterpiece. It's a great movie. Amazingly, I don't even think it's out on DVD, which I don't fully understand how that's possible.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It's very, like, forth-looking. Prescient, is that the pronunciation of that word? But I mean, it's all about reality television, and the fact that it was made in the early 70s is kind of amazing, actually, because it, you know, so heavily predates what we think of as reality television. It's really a film about this documentary crew that moves in with this normal American family with the intention of just filming them in their natural element. And hilarity ensues, let's say, Steve, because as the movie goes on, the documentary filmmaker, played by Brooks himself, becomes more and more manipulative in the lives of these people. And so it's a very clever commentary on how the presence of a camera naturally perverts reality. So it's kind of a brilliant film in that. And again, it's just a very, very funny movie that people really should seek out. I don't know where the hell they'd seek it out at this point, but I think it's possible to find it. And if you have not seen Real Life, I really recommend it.
One of the other guys we should probably mention, both for me personally and from a historical standpoint, is Christopher Guest. Christopher Guest and his collaborators, I mean, they essentially created the mockumentary format, which is a very common format now.
Well, I mean, it's basically, you know, the mockumentary's moved into television pretty much 100%. But I mean, if you think about it, there's, you know, there's so many sitcoms that are basically using that format, and a lot of them are kind of misusing that format. Like,
yeah.
I don't understand why Modern Family has interview segments. Like, who's fucking interview them exactly?
Yeah, it's become an excuse to let your characters break the fourth wall when sometimes it's not motivated. Whereas
not at all.
Christopher Guest movies, and then later The British Office, I mean, they really held tight to the premise that there was a documentary crew filming this.
Right. American Office, too, for that matter.
Yes. So, and now there are other movies, you know, other shows like you said, Modern Family or Parks and Recreation, where it's always a little ambiguous about, like, well, who are they talking to?
It's, you know, forced.
Who's shooting this?
And why?
Yeah.
Yeah. But getting back to Guest, I mean, I got to say, the Spinal Tap, which he didn't direct, but it really is the first official
He
Guest
wrote
movie.
It. Yes, yeah.
It's unbelievably awesome. I can't say enough about how great Spinal Tap is. And what's great about Spinal Tap is there's so much in it. You don't have to be an aficionado of the rockumentary that they're, in fact, lampooning in the film. You don't have to be a rock fan. You don't have to be into any of that stuff. It helps. but you don't have to be to really appreciate the depth of humor in that movie. There's levels upon levels, and there's storylines and character development that's really kind of stunning in that film. And of course, it's hilarious. It's just genuinely hilarious.
Yeah, and he moved, you know, it took a good long, almost 10 years for what would be considered the second Chris. Well, there's The Big Picture, which is a movie about Hollywood, which I recommend people don't see. I've seen that movie. It's not particularly good. Then, you know, kind of the next major film he did was Waiting for Guffman, which takes place in a small, you know, community theater in a town. And, I mean, that movie, I also, that kind of quietly it gained in status, but that to me is one of the funniest movies of the 90s.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Waiting for Guffman is great. And, you know, and again, it's just, I want to just underline the importance of Christopher Guest, because this sort of comedic mockumentary thing, I mean, there's been fake documentaries before that. There's sure. been movies that used interview segments to kind of move the story forward. But what Guest does is just an incredible, like, alchemy of things, of styles and techniques, and it works amazingly well.
He's also I think he's the first to use the purely improvisational script.
Yes.
That the way Christopher Guest movies work is that, you know, he gets together and he comes up with characters and he comes up with an overall scenario. But if you were an actor on a Christopher Guest movie, there's no written lines of dialogue.
Right.
Like, you show up to do a scene, you know who your character is, and you know what in general is supposed to happen in the scene. Sometimes there's a destination about where the scene needs to go. About, you know, by the end of this scene, you know, these guys need to check out of the hotel or something.
Right.
And then within that framework, you see what happens. And that's been, Christopher Guest gets better results than most out of it. It's a technique that's now been almost abused. But one of the reasons Christopher Guest gets such great results out of it is that, like Woody Allen, he is a shameless editor. I mean, Christopher Guest movies are about 90 minutes.
Right.
And from all reports, I mean, you know, he shoots hours and hours and hours right. of footage. But he's disciplined enough to realize that Best in Show should not be 2.5 hours.
Right.
Best
right.
in Show is better if there's just a tight, tight 90 minutes.
Right.
You know?
Right. And he gets it, and he has great people that he works with. Yeah, I think, you know, I think comedy, modern comedy, owes a great... great debt to Christopher Guest. And I hate to say that, you know, over the years his films have somewhat declined in quality. Some of that may have to do with the fact that he's no longer the only guy playing in that sandbox.
Yeah.
And you know, and of course, we have to mention Sacha Baron Cohen. I mean, his Borat specifically, but Bruno to some extent, and even The Dictator to a lesser extent. Really use a lot of the stuff that Guest created.
In some arguably a more daring format, because Borat would, you know, in Borat, he took some of those techniques and took them out into kind of combined Christopher Guest techniques with a candid camera type
Absolutely.
Filming situation.
Absolutely.
Where
Borat interacts with people, unsuspecting yeah, civilians.
Who aren't aware they're in a mockumentary.
Exactly. And you know, Borat is great. I mean, Borat holds up amazingly well. It is consistently funny. But, you know, I think there's only so far you could take that technique. And obviously,
sure.
I think Sacha Baron Cohen himself has run into that wall to some extent.
Yeah, yeah. In some ways, it's admirable that it didn't take him all that long. Like, The Dictator
no.
does not have a full mockumentary
no, not at
vibe
all.
To it.
Yeah.
And even Christopher Guest, his last movie, For Your Consideration, is not a mockumentary.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's
still improvisational, but, you know, he abandoned the gimmick that there's a camera documenting these events.
And it's sadly that the abandonment of the mockumentary, which is kind of a natural process, I think, also corresponds both with Guest and Sacha Baron Cohen with a significant drop-off in quality, too. There, you know, Borat, Cohen's first official film, he had a TV show before that, and Spinal Tap / Waiting for Guffman are definitely the funniest films of their respective careers.
That's true.
And there's just a steady slide downward after those films as the mockumentary, you know, format becomes, I guess, more mainstream and gets appropriated by other artists.
Yeah. I'm curious what, I mean, Christopher Guest has done a TV show now I haven't seen on HBO that's supposed to be pretty good. But, you know, his last movie also suffered from a thing that I just briefly want to touch it. It was a Hollywood satire. And frankly, just as a viewer and someone who's not in Hollywood, I am so tired of the Hollywood satire. Because it doesn't, you know, as an outsider, it doesn't really tell you anything new. And you just get tired of, you feel the overall message is like, okay, people in Hollywood are status obsessed and backstabbing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I got it. And so anytime there's a movie, like say Tropic Thunder, Tropic Thunder, parts of that movie make me laugh a lot. The quote, Hollywood satire, that's the part I like the least. That, you know, like, I mean, Tom Cruise's character is a funny character, but, you know, when people just kind of default say about some of these movies, oh, it's a biting satire. And to me, it's not that biting because it's not telling me anything I haven't heard a bazillion times before.
Yeah, it's not really giving us any real window. It just kind of lampoons the silliness
and
of showbiz.
It just feels like the ultimate insider that people who have to deal with the Hollywood people, obviously, it occupies a large part of their mind. Because,
right.
You know, filmmaker after filmmaker has felt the need to, like, I have to somehow express what it's like to deal with these people. But for, you know, the rest of us, I'm like, okay. It's kind of like somebody coming home and going, my job sucks, my job sucks, my job sucks. And at the end of the day, you're like, I get it, your job sucks.
Yeah, at least you got a job.
I believe you. Well, that's true.
I mean, maybe this would be a good time to talk about some of our favorites from the past few years or overall. Who cares? We got no limitations. We can do whatever we want, Steve. So what do you think? What's some of your favorite comedies of all time? What do you think?
Ah, geez. Yeah, I love Raising Arizona. That movie consistently kills me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one movie that kind of walks the line between, it's basically a goofy movie, but there's some satire going on. The South Park movie. South Park, Bigger, Longer,
well,
and Uncut.
Well, yeah, yes.
I mean, that movie, it's been, like, almost 15 years since that movie came out.
Really? Wow.
And that movie still is one of the funnier things I've seen in the past 20 years.
It is funny, no doubt about that.
Yeah, I love Adaptation. Which
right.
Is,
well, here, you know, the Spike Jonze stuff and is really interesting, especially when he works with
Charlie Kaufman.
That really produces some interesting and bizarre results. And those movies are, of course, fantastic. Pretty much across the board, you know. I mean, I think Being John Malkovich is great. I think Adaptations is even better, you know. And Kaufman is another one of those guys. As a writer, he's certainly done some fascinating things and very funny things, but also strange and quirky. And, you know, I guess they're comedies, but sometimes it's hard to tell. And a lot of that stuff is sort of like, you know, a lot of comedies I tend to like are comedies that don't necessarily make you laugh when you're watching them, but make you laugh after you watch them.
Yeah.
And I think the Charlie Kaufman stuff and, you know, specifically the Spike Jonze directed ones are have that quality to them where you sort of think about them afterwards and are like, wow, that's that was really funny.
Yeah, Alexander Payne has that a lot for me, too.
Absolutely.
One of my favorite endings of any movie of the past 20 years is the end of Election.
Right.
And, I mean, spoiling for anyone who hasn't seen it, but
no.
You know, Matthew Broderick, he sees Tracy Flick, you know, kind of moving up in the world, and he's looking at her, and he starts out being, you know, semi-nice, and then getting angrier and angrier, and he's pissed off at her. And what he does is he throws his, like, full fountain soda at the back of her car. And this causes the car to stop. And then he runs away like a coward.
Right, right.
And it's one of, like, when the first time I saw it, you know, I probably had, like, a chuckle. You know, like, it's like, ah, oh, that's kind of funny. But now it's just, and over the years, it's just funnier and funnier to me. Because it's just such a great combo of the bitterness and then the the pathetic gesture, followed by the cowardly running away, that even that, like, act, you know, this really ridiculous, futile act of aggression, and then he's ashamed of that, and it's
right.
It's all these things going on at once.
And it's great, and it works beautifully. And, I mean, Alexander Payne is really, you know, in my view, one of the masters of the comedy right now. And, again, he's a guy who often, like, people... You know, I mean, obviously people are aware that Alexander Payne's out there making comedies, but, you know, his name is not mentioned when people generally speak of comedy, certainly mainstream comedy. And Election is absolutely on my list as one of the greatest comedies of the last 20 years, definitely. But I think it may be one of the greatest ever. I mean, I think the movie is a friggin' masterpiece. And Sideways is pretty friggin' close. And The Descendants... while a lot more dramatic in the overall balance of drama versus comedy, still hilarious. The guy just has a very light touch. About Schmidt is another film of his that I think is also, you know, he's a great at walking that tightrope between comedy and tragedy. Not tragedy in the old Greek sense, but tragedy of a personal kind, of tragedy of failure, tragedy of unfulfilled dreams. He is such a subtle filmmaker, and his stuff is really, really powerful, and at the same time, really, really hilarious. I absolutely love his stuff. I mean, there's never miss his films, and never really disappointed at anything he's ever done. Yeah, I think he's genuinely great. Wes Anderson is another guy who works in that field. Now, Wes Anderson's very quirky, and again, maybe a bit of an acquired taste, but man, his, you know, when he nails it, he friggin' nails it. My favorite film of his, Royal Tenenbaums, you know, it's hilarious, and also has an element of just outright tragedy in it.
Yeah, that's, I mean, a lot of my favorite filmmakers, not just comedic, but in general, like, most of my favorite filmmakers, there's anything that unites them, it's kind of a sense of absurdity. Like, it's not even comedy or wackiness, but it's, like, you know, I feel people like Alexander Payne and even the Coens that, you know, their take on the world isn't some complete fantasy land. It's just looking at reality from, with, like, being alert to that, you know, real life can be kind of absurd.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of funny. Right? Like,
it is.
And even dark things are kind of funny.
Sometimes the darkest things are, in fact, the funnier things.
You have to laugh or you'd cry.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. But, you know, the two a lot of times go hand in hand because, you know, comedies can have a tendency to really soften you up with laughter. Like, laughter softens you up emotionally. And a lot of good comedies are able to wallop you with the serious stuff to the point where you don't see it coming and you're kind of blindsided by the serious element to the point where you're emotionally really invested in what's going on. And a lot of really, really good comedies have that element where they kind of sneak up on you with, like, really kind of the truth about the meaning of life. And it's a powerful thing. I mean, honestly, it's such a powerful thing. And I think a lot of sort of the disdain that a lot of comedies get from critics is really, you know, really comes from a little of an underestimation of what, like, a good comedy can do. Comedy is very, very powerful. It's a powerful tool. And I think a lot of people are not using it to their full potential.
Yeah.
But guys like the Coen brothers, guys like Alexander Payne, guys like Wes Anderson are using it, and certainly Woody Allen, have used it to its full potential. And then non-comedic filmmakers like Kubrick, in that case, or guys that sort of historically straddle both sides, like Billy Wilder. Man, once you can master that, the ability to make the audience laugh, God, everything else must be pretty friggin' easy, it seems to me. Because it's hard. No, I got it. I really think that. I mean, if you can master manipulating the audience into laughter, just about every other aspect of filmmaking is super easy because drama is much easier to do. Slow push into a cracked door with whispers coming from the room is really all you need to build tension.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, whereas comedy, that's hard, man. You can't, like, do it with a shot. You just can't. What are some of your other favorites?
Well, turning towards some of the goofy side, like, I loved Old School. I actually thought The Wedding Crashers was pretty funny.
Yeah?
Somebody's on a least favorite. I want to give a special little mention of Ben Stiller. Ben Stiller might be on my short list of the most overrated guys of the past 20 years.
Really?
Yeah, because I often find... Well, the funny thing is that out of the Ben Stiller movies, even ones I've liked, if I think about it, the thing I... The worst part of almost any Ben Stiller movie is Ben Stiller. Take a movie like Tropic Thunder, which makes me laugh a lot in parts, but like, man, I hate Ben Stiller in that movie.
Yeah, he seems miscast. Yeah. It's wrong.
A movie like Mystery Men I laugh at parts of, but like I hate Ben Stiller in.
Yeah, well, and, there you go. Not a Ben Stiller fan.
The only exception is maybe there's something about Mary where he's mostly a straight, you know.
Right.
I mean, like, he's good in that movie, but you could argue, I mean, could that have been anybody?
Right.
Well, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, he's hit or miss. You know, he's hit or miss. He's a talented guy, no question about it, but he's certainly not one of those guys who can do anything. He's also one of those guys who falls in the category, like, there's an old adage about a lot of Hollywood comedians not being particularly funny human beings.
Yes.
Like, if you've ever seen an interview with, let's say, Jerry Lewis, he's not funny.
No.
Jerry Lewis is not a funny man. He's kind of scary, frankly. And a lot of comedians have that quality. I mean, you could probably say the same thing about Jim Carrey. And from everything I've seen, and I actually met Ben Stiller one time, years and years ago, before he was quote-unquote Ben Stiller. And let me tell you, that guy ain't funny at all. He's not particularly pleasant either. That's a common thing in a lot of comedians, where, like, it's weird that they're funny, actually. It's kind of weird, because they don't seem to have a fantastic sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas a lot of these writers, actually, are kind of what make it work. And, of course, that comes down to writing. You know? And that's... I guess that's another key to what makes a good comedy, right?
What about you, Andre? Anything we haven't mentioned yet?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to go too far in the past, but I am actually a... I'm not going to go into the black and white world. There's lots of great comedies from that, and I'm not going to talk about some like it hot. Of course, everybody knows about that. You know, I think the original Nutty Professor is a friggin' hilarious movie. And I think, speaking of Jerry Lewis, I mean, that is a kind of a brilliant film that actually does have something to say. Just on Jerry's own, like, world at the time, because it was definitely a commentary on his pairing with Dean Martin. But the movie is funny, and it holds up pretty well. I mean, it's got some goofy, you know, 50s stuff in it, but at the same time, it really, really works. And, you know, moving forward, I know I said I wouldn't go into black and white, but, you know, I just got to say that Dr. Strangelove is a friggin' masterpiece and is a movie that really, really grows on you with every viewing.
Sure.
You know, and then getting into the 70s, I mentioned the Mel Brooks stuff. I'm not a giant fan of The Producers, but I think Young Frankenstein is kind of a masterpiece. And I do think Airplane, pound for pound in terms of laughs, one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Sure.
Kind of a big fan of a couple of Rodney Dangerfield films from the 80s. I know it's weird.
Yeah.
Well, Easy Money and Back to School both are great. Especially Easy Money. Easy Money definitely falls under the heading of like a genuinely good film. It's actually like a good movie. It has a character arcs. It has character developments. It's got a lot of jokes. It's got a lot of gags. And, of course, it does revolve around your ability to enjoy Rodney Dangerfield. If you don't like Rodney, you're probably not going to like Easy Money.
Sure.
But I'd say give that movie a spin. And there is a lot to love about that film. And speaking of Rodney, you know, I think we got to mention Caddyshack. I know everybody talks about Caddyshack, but, man, that movie's funny. There's a lot. Again, I do enjoy, you know, from a scattershot perspective, which is to say movies that don't really have a serious vein in them, but just designed to get a lot of laughs. Caddyshack is really great because it also, like Airplane, it has a lot of these different elements. It has It does have a little bit something to say about class struggle, but not, you know, it doesn't really beat you over the head with it. But at the same time, it's got a lot of different types of humor. It's got the physical, it's got the toilet humor, frankly, and it also has some just clever jokes and one-liners and, you know, stuff you actually got to think about. And some great performances. Rodney's great. I think Chevy Chase has never been better on film than he is in that film. It does hold up. It, you know, and that's another thing. A lot of comedies don't hold up. They have a short shelf life. You know, I kind of like watching a movie 10 years after and going, yeah, that works. I like Superbad.
Yeah.
I like, that's a Judd Apatow kind of a world.
Sure, he had a hand in that. He had
absolutely enjoyed it. I like Anchorman. It's a silly movie, but there's lots of laughs in it. And very character-based.
Anchorman's an interesting one because, to me, Anchorman is one of those movies that, as a film, is kind of disappointing. But
the characters
and some of the scenes are so good that it covers up a lot of sins.
Right.
And that, to me, that movie's almost more fun to quote afterwards.
Right.
Than, like, sitting in the darkened theater watching.
Yeah, the characters are so funny and the gags are so funny in it that it's fun. I wouldn't put it in the same league as Dr. Strangelove, but certainly good stuff. Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to, like, go outside of the American film, but I want to talk about a couple of British movies that I really, really like. I love Monty Python generally, but I think The Meaning of Life is fantastic. I think that's a crazy, like, multiple... That is just skits, you know?
I would almost call that the weakest one, even though it makes me laugh
It does. I do love it, and, you know, and The Holy Grail is fantastic.
The Holy Grail is great.
It's just fantastic. Again, holds up beautifully. And from recent years, I'm a big fan of comedian Steve Coogan, and especially stuff that he's done with director Michael Winterbottom. And a few years ago, the movie The Trip came out. And The Trip, it's really a compilation. When it was released in the U.S., it's a compilation of a British TV series. And the TV series is basically Steve Coogan playing himself and his buddy Rob Brydon also playing himself. And they're basically driving in their car across England, eating at nice restaurants. And yes, they do have nice restaurants in England, apparently. I didn't realize that. It's true, they do.
Not just boiled potatoes.
And they
dishes.
Talk. And all it is, there's no plot. All they do is talk. And a lot of their conversations are really just impersonation contests. Like, who can do a better Michael Caine impression? The movie is very, very funny. And it's a weirdly affecting, too. Like, it does have stuff going on with the characters. And there's kind of a subtle way with which that's expressed. And I really love that film. And if you like British humor and if you've enjoyed Steve Coogan's work in the past, you should see that. As a matter of fact, I would even recommend seeing the actual original British TV show, which basically is the same as a film, just has more stuff in it. So it's like the film is an hour and a half. The TV show is 3 hours. So it's like watching two of those movies. The Trip, really, really good stuff.
Okay. Well, I feel like I should add on a couple, because when you asked me that question, I basically answered only movies from the past 15 years.
Yeah, go
so
for it.
So when you went back, I felt embarrassed. I felt like I'm going to be judged harshly.
No.
At the beginning of the podcast, I mentioned The Graduate, which is one of my all-time favorite films, which I would call a comedy. And a satire.
Definitely.
And still
Mike
holds
Nichols,
up.
Great,
I mean, yeah, there are aspects of it that are certainly of its time. That said, big fan of The Graduate. Big fan of Harold and Maude.
Fantastic film.
Which is a loose template for half of Wes Anderson's career.
Well,
that kind of tone.
Hal Ashby was a genius.
Yeah.
You know, he really, really was an amazing filmmaker. And he was one of those guys where his movies are funny, but they also got a lot of power. I mean, Harold and Maude will make you cry.
Yes.
It's a powerful film, but it's also a hilarious film.
Yes.
And it's a film that makes you laugh at stuff that's actually not funny.
Correct.
And then makes you cry about the same shit. And it's, I mean, Hal Ashby was really, really brilliant. I do think he's been incredibly influential, but strangely enough, you know, a lot of people don't not talked a lot about.
No, you know? Dying was not a good career move
for him. Not
for him.
He
was already fading out a little bit when, at the time of his death. And now it's, you know, he's, when people talk about the great directors of the 70s, he's often like a footnote to that, but, like, in the discussions, but he maybe shouldn't be. Hal Ashby made some great films.
Oh, yeah.
Another guy is kind of forgotten from my youth that, you know, you and I didn't mention him at all until right now, but Eddie Murphy made some very funny movies, like between Beverly Hills Cop and 48 Hours, and I'm a huge, growing up, I loved Coming to America.
I love Coming to America, too. I enjoy that film, and yeah, Eddie Murphy.
That movie holds up to me, and yeah.
Yeah, it's very watchable over and over again, actually, and they show it a lot. And, 48 Hours is, strictly speaking, not a comedy. It's kind of a cop buddy movie.
Sure.
And it's kind of a blueprint for a cop buddy movie, actually.
Yeah.
But, man, that movie's funny. And it's funny because of him. And he's got a great rapport with Nick Nolte, who's not known for being funny.
Yeah.
But, man, that works so well. I love that film. And that sort of falls under, the category of a genre movie that's got a lot of comedy in it, but is not, per se, a comedy.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking of guys who at least at one point were not known for being funny, one of my favorite 80s movies is Midnight Run.
Yes.
And I mean, that movie holds up, and it's great.
Well,
that's
definitely the 48 Hours vein, you know what I mean? It's got that.
I would call that movie, though, a comedy.
Yeah,
I mean, like,
it's more of a comedy than 48 Hours.
With the late Dennis Farina.
Oh, yes.
If you have not seen Midnight Run in a while, I mean, not only does it hold up and it's hilarious, even today, that movie has a shocking amount of cursing.
It is.
Like, you're kind of taken aback.
It is.
And it doesn't even, I mean, I guess you notice how much it is, but in the world of the movie, it works.
It works perfectly.
And there are even jokes built around it.
Of course.
The famous, here's two words for you, shut the fuck up.
Yes. You know, even though comedians also have a very short shelf life, it almost seems like a lot of comic actors really have a window where they're funny. Like, for example, I'm not sure that anybody gives a shit about, like, Robin Williams as a comedic actor now. Robin Williams is getting a sitcom, or it may not even be a sitcom, strictly speaking. It may just be
a TV series. It's a sitcom, yeah.
Well, I mean, that may be successful, and that's a different sort of world for him. But, you know, it seems like his funny expiration date is definitely here. You know?
Yeah.
It seems like the stuff he seems to understand that as well. Ditto for Jim Carrey. I don't think people really particularly give a shit about Jim Carrey anymore. The last two films he was in, were really, really weak and from a performance perspective. And he was intentionally trying to be funny in him, and he's certainly featured in the ad campaign as a funny guy. So,
Like Will Ferrell, the clock is ticking.
I think the clock is totally ticking.
The past couple Will Ferrell movies have underperformed at the box office, and now, I mean, he's turned to sequels.
Well,
so, like, Remember Me as this beloved character.
Right, Anchorman 2 is coming out, and that could be great or not, we'll see.
But it's still, a new Will Ferrell movie does not have the cachet it did 3 years ago.
Yeah, but I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that Will Ferrell had a couple of turkeys last year. I mean, genuine turkeys, okay? That campaign movie was not good at all, and Casa de Mi Padre was not good.
But you're right. Like, a lot of these comedic actors, you have this little window where the public's loving your shtick, and you got to strike while the iron's hot.
Yeah.
And then, then it fades. I mean, I'd say this all roads lead back to Adam Sandler, apparently, in this discussion. But Adam Sandler has milked his shtick farther than I would have thought possible.
Yeah. Well, he mixes it up, He'll do a funny voice nonsense, silly character, and then he'll do just kind of a straight-up performance where he'll get a bunch of his friends together and do, Grown Ups 3 or whatnot.
Yeah.
I mean, those movies are horrible, but I guess people enjoy them and people take their
kids. I mean, it's kind of fascinating to me that Adam Sandler made, Judd Apatow's Funny People, where his role in that movie is almost a satirical portrait of himself.
Yeah.
And so if you watch that movie, I mean, the character in that movie is almost openly disdainful of these broad comedies he's made.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess as a mark of how not well Funny People did is the fact that Adam Sandler made a movie where he played a character a lot like Adam Sandler, and that character made these broad comedies that made a lot of money, but Adam Sandler's character was like, well, we all kind of know that shit. And then Adam Sandler, the real actor, went right back to making movies like that.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's weird. You could argue that he more or less bluntly told the public, like, you guys will buy fucking anything.
Yeah.
And
well, I mean, he gets it. I mean, they're not. That's another thing about comedians. They may not be funny necessarily as human beings, but they tend to be pretty smart as human beings.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of really dumb comedians out there, even the ones that make dumb comedies. You know, in recent years, coming back, again, I have to mention Adaptation. I have to mention Knocked Up. I love those films. In the romantic comedy world, 500 Days of Summer, I think, is terrific and kind of original in its own way, even though that may be more of a romantic movie than a comedy movie, but it's got a lot of comedy in it. And we, of course, lamented how bad 2013 has been. Well, one of the better films I've seen this year is This Is the End, with Seth Rogen and James Franco. I mean, I love that film. I think that's kind of a new classic. And that movie also, as loose and scattershot as it is, does in fact have something to say. It's got a perspective on the world we live in. And it's a kind of a fresh and interesting perspective that I haven't seen before. I really recommend This Is the End. When it comes out on video, see it. It's really one of the best films of 2013. But, you know, it's funny because it's like a lot of people just like to watch the latest comedy. Like, again, this brings us to what we were saying, which is kind of a short shelf life. A lot of people are not interested in seeing comedies from days gone by. And I think it's a mistake because the good ones age great. The bad ones don't.
It's true.
But the good ones age great. You know, and I'm just wondering, like, a lot of these movies, like, you know, we could talk about the overrated comedies of the past few years. And I think I gotta go right to The Hangover for that one. I mean, I don't know how The Hangover is going to play in 10 years. It may play good.
Yeah.
But for me, I found it a little empty.
You know? Yeah, The Hangover is one of those movies that I saw 3 weeks after it came out, maybe longer, and I saw it in a crowd of 20 people, and I was kind of like, yeah, what's the big deal? Like, I didn't hate it, but that was all right. I do wonder if that movie, if I saw on the opening weekend, if I would have loved it. You know, some of these movies, like, I saw The Wedding Crashers on opening weekend with a big crowd, and that did, it was enough, you know, it had a positive effect on my enjoyment of the movie. And some of these movies are made to be watched. You do have a different experience.
Absolutely.
If you've got a large group of people who are ready to laugh.
Yeah, seeing a comedy in a crowded theater is a good experience. Seeing a good comedy in a crowded theater is a good experience. And it's funny, and it's a weird duality with comedies, because on the one hand, you know, most comedies don't have the visual panache to really warrant the big screen showing. But on the other hand, the best way to experience a comedy is a kind of a group experience. And there's the duality. And I find myself kind of torn a little bit, because a lot of time I'm like, well, it's a comedy. Do I really need to see it in the theater? And then you kind of miss something when you see it on video down the line, because, you know, there's none of that kind of a group hilarity that happens.
Sure.
You know? On the other hand, you know, it's so often that I do go see a comedy at the movies, and it turns out to be really weak.
Like,
really friggin' weak.
Yeah, one of my bigger disappointments in recent years was I saw this movie, Horrible Bosses. And Horrible Bosses has some laughs in it, and it has some actors I all like. But, yeah, as you said, visually, that movie was so lazy. I mean, just god-awful. And, you know, there's a couple scenes in that movie where the three main characters meet for drinks, and they meet at, you know, a TGI Fridays or equivalent, something like that. And, I mean, that scene is lit so shitty. And you're just like, man, can you guys just try a little? Can you just
right.
do something other than just turn the camera on and point it at the funny bear?
I guess it's just so hard to make people laugh, Steve.
Yeah.
That maybe, you know, trying to throw in cinematic tricks into the mix just is really an impossibility for most directors. You know, and that's why you got to appreciate guys like the Coen brothers
yeah.
and Alexander Payne and Wes Anderson, guys like that, who can bring the laughs and give you some cinematic panache at the same time.
Well, I'd hope to see some more of that stuff going forward. But, you know, I'm not writing off all wacky comedies forever. Some of them are still pretty good.
Absolutely not. And this is a subject that we could go on and on forever, if we haven't already. So thanks for joining us again. I'm Andre Shane.
Steve Askins. This is Film Driven.
We're out of here. The bigger the cushion, the sweeter.